I am Platt on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Laura Lee Rosano joins me again. The author and counselor was on last year for her novel Jagged Little Edges. Jagged Little Lies is the second book of a trilogy. I'll get her to bring us up to date with Lindsay and the rest of the characters in this book. We'll talk about the problems of addiction in our communities and more. Laura Lee Rosano is a family counselor at the Edgewood Treatment Center in Nanaimo. When we talked last year, we talked about her own addictions, how she managed those, and what the process of recovery has meant for her life, her family, and her work now. The website for more is at jaggedlittleedges.com, where you can get the book. Please welcome back to the Plant Online program, Laura Lee Rosano. Ms. Rosano, good morning.
Good morning, Joseph. It's great to be with you again.
It's nice to talk to you again, yeah. So the reaction to the first book, that was pretty good, wasn't it? I mean, I read a few reviews online. They were quite effusive in their praise of it.
Yeah, it was. It was really good. It was, which was really nice to see. And you know, Joseph, one of the things I've done is just I've really opened the doors to communication with my readers. So we do interactive author speaks on Facebook and in private messaging and things. And of course, you know, a lot of people in addiction are really either still stuck in that or just barely moving beyond it, and they have a lot of questions, or family members have a lot of questions, and sometimes they don't want to ask those questions in public venues. So I've really kind of welcomed my followers to ask me questions, to have chats, to, you know, brainstorm different ideas, and some of them have made some real differences in their lives. So it's been quite an exciting journey. I've always been a reader, and I could never imagine, you know, being able to contact the author of those books, ask them questions, and be able to, you know, have those experiences. So that's something I've been doing with the folks, and it's been really great for all of us, I think.
And so people inevitably, whether they're addicts or not, have their personal experiences and share those with you, right?
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely.
What's that like when someone gets personal like that?
I think that's what we're all looking for in relationships, when someone gets personal like that. It's called vulnerable and intimacy, and that's when we acknowledge the truth of our existence, be it whatever it is, because whether it's addiction, mental health, marriage dissolving, problems with, you know, raising our kids, or you know, even I had a fight with my husband last night. Everybody in this world has things on their plate that, you know, they need to deal with. So when someone opens up for me, that's what this is all about. I think that's why I was possibly granted sobriety. I mean, why else, you know, why else would something? It's a wonderful experience, Joseph. It really provides a safe atmosphere without the judgment. You know, and the shame and blame, and oh, we shouldn't have done that, and the finger wag. And when people are able to have that safety and really open up about what's going on, they don't have to have their defenses up. And as long as their defenses aren't up, they can actually hear some feedback and let that sink in and process and possibly make the necessary changes. So it's really a win-win for both parties.
The one thing that I've learned in reading your work in the last year or so, is the idea of I learned a lot about recovery and addictions and the sort, but the key, I guess, and you've just said the word is no judgment.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that's two words. But it was something that we've been reading about in the news in the last week or so, in several days, is the death of Philip Seymour Hoffman. And he's obviously a remarkable actor, someone that a lot of people have admired over the years. But the idea of him, I mean, these are just news reports, of course, that he was found dead with a needle hanging out of his arm, led a lot of people, especially online, to judge him.
Mm-hmm.
In light of his death rather than his life.
Right.
What's the one thing that we can learn from this experience, especially the death of Philip Seymour Hoffman, which is obviously a big news story around the world?
Yeah. Well, first of all, you know what? I've got a couple of ideas going on, and hopefully I'll be able to vocalize them.
Yeah.
I think I'm going to start with the words judging, and I really want to let your listeners know that when we judge folks, that isn't about us saying someone else did something. Our judgment is really a mirror of who we are within. So the next time you find yourself pointing a finger and judging, know that really isn't about that person. That's about something within your own self. And that's something you might want to start taking a look at. What is that about? Because if you're doing that, chances are your relationships aren't as successful as they could be. Your work environment won't be as successful as it could be. Your home environment won't. There's something within you that needs addressing. So that's my little bit on judgment. Really, our attitudes, the way we think, the way we behave, the way we feel, are a complete mirror reflection of what the truth is going on within us. So when I see people doing that, it tells me a lot about them, you know, and not in a judging place, just in a factual place.
Mm-hmm.
So if we can take the judgments away, can you imagine how quickly we could move into solution in this society? So. As far as Philip Hoffman Seymour, it's not shocking that a person with addiction relapses after 21 or 23 years or after 30 years. When you have addiction, you're never cured. You live in a period of grace and maintenance, and it's really it's reliant on what you do to maintain that position. So I guess for me it isn't so much shocking about Philip Hoffman's. The judgment was a little shocking,
mm-hmm.
although not really, sadly, not really. We see it all the time, and I think that's part of the stigma attached to addiction. What for me was the real tragedy is Philip didn't get there alone. He didn't die in his room alone with a needle out of his arm. I mean, there were so many people involved in that journey. Any one of them could have made a difference, and this could be a completely different story we're having. And that's the important thing. You know, when you see someone that is clearly not making the best choices, and you can see they're isolating, their lip disheveled, their speech, their physical body doesn't look the same, their emotional body doesn't look the same, we can tell someone's in trouble long before they're ever putting needles in their arm. So I guess my question is, where were the people who loved him? I hope they were speaking up, and this isn't judgment against them either, but it's really looking at our opportunities to make a difference and have conversations with people when we are concerned for them, regardless of what that looks like.
Why are we uncomfortable in undertaking those conversations? I mean, we probably see signs
mm-hmm.
everywhere in
yeah.
our personal lives, and I guess there is a gap there between what we see and what we'll actually do
yeah.
eventually.
Well, a lot of us are uncomfortable because we're partaking in the party, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, really, if I'm going to talk to you about addiction, I'm going to kind of be in a position to have to look at my own usage. So that's one of them. That's one of them. The other one is maybe I've kind of bailed you out of a few things. Or thirdly, sometimes when we talk to folks about addiction, they become really mean and abusive to us, and that's it becomes a hurtful experience, and so we withdraw from that and think, well, I'm not rocking the boat, or I'll just never talk to the guy again, and none of those are, you know, the way to deal with it. And most of us today, most of us today are not particularly great at wanting to walk through uncomfortable situations. And an addiction is about one of the most uncomfortable you can get. I mean, you think about it, if you've ever experienced going to visit someone terminally ill from cancer in the hospital, it's uncomfortable. It's really, you know, all those situations are difficult. We don't know what to say. We don't know what to do. We don't want to upset the person. And I say upset away. I mean, you know, you it's really important to have those conversations and understand when someone's under the guise of addiction, they're no longer acting under their best thinking anyway. So if you're expecting them to get it or be appreciative, sometimes you may be a little disappointed, but don't let that discourage you.
In the acknowledgments of your new book, your latest book, Jagged Little Lies,
mm-hmm.
You write that 1 in 10 are affected by addiction, but I suspect it's more than that. We have people around you.
Yeah, I do too now.
Yeah.
Although we don't have for sure stats, we're looking at more about 1 in 7 now.
Yeah.
And, you know, here's the difficulty in that. We tend to focus on the addict.
Yeah.
So, but the truth is the addict has a family system or a social system around them, and everybody's equally affected, and everybody is equally as sick. And I want to say those words really nicely. I do mean sick. I don't mean bad.
Uh-huh.
But I mean sick, where our behaviors and judgments start to become just as impaired as the person, you know, that's clearly using drugs or substance or whatever it is they're doing, shopping, gambling, whatever. Because in order to stay in relationship with addiction, we need to make accommodations. You know, we need to start using some of the same essential symptoms that the alcoholic or addict is displaying, you know, where we minimize, justify, rationalize, deflect, protect, deny. Because you can't take a healthy person into an addict and get the addict well. Usually what happens is the healthy person becomes sick. So you know, really working with addiction, we need to involve a whole community in a way of, you know, of professionals, of people who kind of walked this journey before. And so with a family, what I'd like to say, if anyone has anyone, you know, they love suffering from addiction, rather than, you know, trying to get them well, really look at getting support and education for yourself, because you need to know this. As you start this journey, it's going to be a really difficult, bumpy, perhaps long road. And you really need the support in order to really stay the course, because if you don't, it's just easier to give in and be manipulated and, you know, kind of somewhat living somewhat resentfully than it is to actually make those healthy choices and keep those firm boundaries in place. So there's a lot that needs to be learned. We tend to think addiction looks like Easton Hastings, and and that's what it is, and that's about as far as it'll ever get from addiction. That's not even 1%. I mean, most alcoholics and addicts and sex addicts and shopping people and, you know, shopping addictions and gambling addictions and so on and so on, and internet now, are functioning in society. And so how, you know, it's just that they're not functioning to the best quality they could. I mean, something's jeopardized from their behavior. So
the characters in this book, I mean, Lindsay, we've met her in the previous book. Could you take us to where she is now in the second book, Jagged Little Lies?
Sure. Well, she has, you know, she's sobered up, she's cleaned up, she's got 10 or so years under her belt, and she's working in a treatment center, and she's working with the families of, you know, the families of the folks who are addicted. And so what she's experiencing and starting to understand is nobody with addiction gets there alone. Like I say, it's a real family system around it. So Jagged Little Lies really shows the family how their life starts to spiral out of control along with the addicts. And you can imagine when my emotional well-being is completely entrenched in how someone else doing, I'm going to make sure they're doing okay, right? And that's what addiction counts on. So it really shows in a very easy, readable way what happens. And sometimes with families, you know, we see them, they come in looking somewhat sicker than the person with addiction, because families develop symptoms of high blood pressure, ulcers, headaches, depression, isolation, sometimes overeating. They start to rely on things like sleeping pills or Ativan because they're under so much anxiety and stress. And so you can see that sometimes they start to develop addiction disorders themselves too, or at least their lives is very, very impacted by it.
So the book opens, I guess, we're in a prison. I guess that's Declan who's in jail, right?
Yep, that's Declan who's in jail, and he's detoxing. And for the very first time in his life, he's not able to manipulate anyone. You know, there was a thing recently on the news, they called it affluenza. Did you ever hear about that, Justin?
Yeah, the illness of, well, I guess it's a, well, you'll explain it. It's something to do with the rich, right? Yeah.
I think it's the illness of 2014, personally, and exactly. I don't think you have to be incredibly rich to have it. What it is it's when we do for our, you know, when we overdo for our kids, and most of us overdo for our kids because we're feeling guilt ourselves.
Yeah.
Perhaps it's because our marriage is broke up, or we've got both parents working, and they're, you know, latchkey kids. And so we want to overcompensate the fact that, you know, so we do these things for our kids, not for their well-being, but to make us feel better. So a lot of what we're seeing today, particularly in our youth, is entitlement. And, you know, entitlement really means, you know, you owe me. I'm you know, it's you got to, you know, pay. And Declan has, in his short experience in life, he was adopted, and he came into a family where mom was so darn happy to have this precious little bundle. They tried to have a baby that, you know, when she got him, she spoiled him rotten to the detriment of her own marriage. And, of course, you know, that works really great for addiction. And so for the very first time, Declan's in jail, and he isn't able to manipulate anyone. And, you know, and so he's starting to face some of those consequences. And, of course, alcoholics don't get well until the consequences become greater than the rewards. And so this is why it's so important, if, you know, if we really want to help someone get well, that we completely understand that and are able to provide that. So that's where he opens up, and it's not a very pretty picture for him in Jagged Little Lies. Yeah.
So Susan, that's the mother. She's the one that you just described to us, and she's got her own addiction as well, right?
Well, and you know, and I want to, you know, so many, I'm sure there's so many people who've kind of thought like me, I used to think that happiness was a new home, a new relationship, a new car, a beautiful car, a great job, money in the bank, tropical vacation, good kids, nice clothes, great shoes, okay? And she's got all those and more. She's got everything any woman could possibly ever want. She doesn't have to work. She's been well provided for. Granite countertops, the whole spiel. And we start to understand through her journey, happiness isn't about any of that. It isn't about any of that. And I don't know if anyone else has kind of come to this conclusion, but for me, happiness is an inside-out job. And so it kind of takes you through her journey and understandings. And I think a lot of women are really going to relate to where what she's experiencing and where she's at.
And I guess that's where we are in terms of popular culture. I mean, the story that you tell in this book sort of reflects where we are in terms of, say, our economy and the thing you were talking about a moment ago, affluenza. I mean,
yeah,
you're really
absolutely
reflecting what's going on nowadays.
Yeah, and we have a buy now, pay later society.
Yeah.
We sure have it when it comes to addiction. Oh, my goodness. I mean, I have to be careful right now. I have some very strong views of what's going on with crack pipe vending machines and
mm-hmm.
things like that in Vancouver. So I don't want to hang myself too badly. I could tell you this. Crack cocaine was my drug of choice 16 years ago. My sobriety date's May. So, if, you know, hopefully I'll be lucky enough to make that. I don't ever take mine for granted. We've got today. But had there been crack pipe vending machines and things like that, you know, I don't know what would I'm just so glad that wasn't there for me anyways, and I think, you know, having crack pipe vending machines covered in polka dots really sends a message that maybe we don't want to be sending. See, I understand it's cheaper to look at harm reduction and try to you know, really clean up the HIV population and Hep C and things like that, but I wonder what detriment this is, because when we try to take a short, quick fix to a really complex problem, what we're doing now is we pay now, we buy now, but we pay later. We really do. We pay later. And I think that we need to, as a society, develop the ability to walk through these things and not need to solve them like this, because the damage we do down the road, the message we send out, the shift of what is happening now, you know, I sometimes wonder, in the quiet of my own mind, I think, is this really happening? Like, why aren't we standing up and saying anything about this? I couldn't have thought 20 years ago, I would never have thought we would be here. And I wonder, if we keep quiet, where we'll be in 20 years from now. So I know these are all very difficult subjects to address. I think we're getting, you know, we're kind of in murky waters. Nobody, you know, I think when it comes to politics and all sorts of things, somewhat distrustful and cynical. And I don't know how to solve any of these things, but I certainly know this. Silence doesn't help it. Judging doesn't help it. There's other ways, you know, and they're not going to be quick fixes, and you do need to throw some money at them. But we're throwing money at them anyways. Let's make that money something that's actually going to work for us instead of against us down the road.
I just thought of, I didn't read it, but I read bits of it. Was an article about the death of Philip Seymour Hoffman, that perhaps harm reduction could have saved his life had there been, like, had he been at Insight or something like that.
Well, you know, you think about I doubt it.
Yeah.
Would Philip Hoffman Seymour go to Insight? No, he's not going to cross into a shooting gallery and make that a public appearance. Are you kidding? No, I don't think so. I don't think that he would have done that at all. I mean, he was trying to keep it secret. That's why, you know, most addicts are. I mean, unless you've really hit that very last stage where you kind of, excuse my French, say F it, and you don't care anymore. But most, you know, I think that most people still are going to want to protect that secret. Certainly, I think a celebrity would. Can you imagine? I'm not sure. Could have. I don't know. You know, like I said, I have my own opinions on that. I think that we deem people towards the end of their illness and kind of untreatable, and so we give them these options. But I have my own experience. I know that there's no good reason for me to be alive today. There's no good reason for me to be breathing in air other than to be having these conversations, because I was so far gone at the end of my addiction, really, I mean, I would have absolutely, I'm sure, been an insight had it been around back in the day. I don't think I wouldn't be here. Mm-hmm. But my message is this: if I can recover, anybody can. And I don't mean that facetiously. I mean, there was nothing honest or valuable about my thinking, my behavior. I was a nuisance to society. I was horrible to love. I was a tornado in my own home. I was hurtful to my children. I took from society and I didn't give back anything, and I didn't care. I had no values, morals, or integrity or self-respect left at all. Someone cared enough to toe a really hard line with me. And for the very first time in my life, I couldn't run, I couldn't manipulate, I couldn't, I couldn't get people to buy into my stuff. And very, very slowly but surely, I started to move away from that position. And that didn't happen in 30 days or 3 months or 3 years. I mean, it was a process. It's still ongoing. But I guess, you know, if we invest in this process, if we invest in things that are really proven to work, and I do believe in treatment, I'm 100%, what we have is people who can come back and give to society in a way that you wouldn't believe. Like, I do so many of us do so much that is unnoticed and uncalled for it and unpaid, and yet that's part of what we need to do to keep what was so nicely given to us. So you've got a lot of people that'll go back into society and more than make up whatever they took away. And I think that would, you know, really make a big difference in what we're looking at.
Well, we spoke a moment ago about, say, where we are in terms of our popular culture, our society and the sort. I read a great book this fall by Ann Dowsett Johnston. I think it's Johnson or Johnston. Is talking about how liquor is so prevalent, and how a female's relationship with liquor is a lot more dangerous than, say, it is between liquor and a man, just because of say genetics and as well as marketing, which I think is important. But what happens when you see someone like Rob Ford in the press, who I mean, that sends a message. Yeah. To young people, especially, but I mean, not necessarily. I mean, it sends a message saying, you know, that this is a people that are, yeah, you know, people won't particularly like him. I mean, they make fun of him, but I mean, for some people, it doesn't mean that.
Well, I mean, we're sending all kinds of messages. This is what I mean. 20 years ago, who would have thought this? Look at Justin Bieber. Yeah. I mean, if you want to send a message to the young people, let's just use his example again. Why wouldn't he be acting like that? I think I would if I was his age with that kind of adoration and money and, you know, celebrity status. And I mean, why do we put people on those pedestals in the first place? But anyhow, that's a whole different topic. But, you know, as far as Mayor Ford, Robert Mayor Ford, I mean, that was so predictable. This is why addiction is so treatable. It is completely treatable because it is so predictable. I mean, you can't, without treatment and changing the way you think, feel, and behave, you can't just put the plug in the jug and think that it's not going to come out somewhere else. It's like a balloon. It'll just blow up somewhere else. And so it wasn't very shocking that he didn't last very long, or wasn't, you know, the behavior still continued, because addiction isn't about what you use. It isn't about how much you drink. It's about what's going on below the surface. And when that's not addressed, it'll still continue on. You know, and again, he was a great one for ridicule and things. That bothers me that as a society we are so much more comfortable pointing fingers and ridiculing and judging after the fact. But where is everybody before the fact? You know, like, is that what we've come to? And how proud is that? I mean, you know, I don't think so much. I'm not bothered by what Mayor Robert Ford did. I mean, he's an alcoholic. He just did what every alcoholic would do. I'm more bothered by our response to it and how easy it is to shake and wag a finger. I mean, that for me is the real disturbing news here.
Yeah. So how does society change then? How do we say change the minds of, say, the late night comics and the sort?
Well, I think society changes by taking a look in their own backyard. Right?
Yeah.
Let's you know what, who am I to judge anyone? What have I got going on in my world that I would be so arrogant and ungodly as to want to judge yours? And usually there's the start. something, you know what, when we don't feel particularly good about our own selves, it's kind of nice to point a finger and laugh at someone else. Takes the pressure off of what's going on in our own home, right? Or in our own workspace, or in our own life, or in the way we think. So, you know, the next time you see yourself wagging a finger, remember there's three pointing back. So start there. When you catch yourself judging, ask yourself, what is that about? What is going on with me? Everything we do is just an invitation to get to know your own self better, you know, because once you start to develop the ability to really, you know, take an inventory of your behaviors, of your emotions, of your role in things, you will start to really shift away from that place, I think, because, you know, if I'm going to be judging others, you know, I need to understand that, there's some real problems behind that, and that's just a way of, you know, me kind of shifting away from and avoiding my own stuff, if you will. That's what I love about recovery, I think, Joseph, is the fact that who on this planet, I mean, we don't learn this in school, we don't learn it in university. Where is there a course 101 called me? Why do I do these things? Why do I behave this way? Why do I get mad if someone cares about me? Why do I kind of get uncomfortable in really intimate situations? Why do I want to point a finger? And so, you know, recovery really teaches us to take a very, very good look at our own being and to watch our expectations of others and to stop judging and to practice acceptance and to practice kindness and respect and all of those things. And I think once we can start to practice those things, we found a solution. Because, you know, who would want to ever come clean these days saying they're an addict or an alcoholic and they need help? After what we've been witnessing in, you know, in the media for the last year, when someone, you know, has a problem with it. You know what I saw? One of the things about Philip Hoffman Sr.,
yeah.
Seymour, is, if you use heroin, you deserve to die.
Yeah.
And I thought, wow, you know, and so we've got all sorts of comments in between. So, you know, there's just a real reflection of our ignorance and things, you know, and judgment when it comes to that. So, you know, I talk about it. I invite people to talk about it. I invite people not to shy away from these conversations. You have no idea how your conversation can simply start a ball rolling on a different path for someone. And so, you know, when you shy away from the conversation, you're not helping anyone else. You're just trying to avoid some uncomfortable feelings.
Yeah.
And that in itself is as selfish as addiction.
I've enjoyed talking to you today as well as our previous chats, and I'm looking forward to the next time we'll talk again. I guess that's when the next book comes out, number 3?
Yeah, I know its name, but I can't say it yet. I haven't copyrighted it, but I'm working on it as we speak.
Yeah, I mean, these characters are fairly interesting people, and the way that you weave them together and bring us their stories, as well as these stories that really are relatable and universal.
Yes,
it's quite an achievement and an accomplishment on your part. So congratulations on that, and continued good luck with these books.
Well, thank you so much for having me on today, Joseph.
You're very welcome. The website for more, jaggedlittleedges.com. The new book is called Jagged Little Lies, and you can get the book there. You can also get that on Amazon. Its author, Laura Lee Rosano, joined me on the line from Nanaimo in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Ponto.